Welcome to our podcast where we discuss all things breast reconstruction. And today I'm very honored to have my mentor, colleague, and esteemed guest, Dr. Melvin J. Silverstein, joining us, who is Professor Emeritus of Surgery at University of Southern California and has a pretty illustrious career in breast reconstruction and cancer surgery. So maybe could you start off by giving us a little bit of background on yourself? I know everything about you. I've heard all your stories, but I think it'd be nice for everyone else to hear.
So Dr. Savaglia and I have been friends for many years. We've operated 1,000 cases together, and we shared lots of time in the operating room talking about our lives. And so this is two good friends talking. What was the question again?
Well, why don't you start with how you became specifically a breast cancer surgeon?
Oh, that's an interesting story. So this goes way back to my days in the United States Army. I was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, 1970 to 72. And breast cancer at that time was one disease. It was not the nuanced disease that we think of today with multiple different ways of dealing with it and multiple subtle things that make it different. It was one disease treated with one method, which was the old-fashioned Halsted radical mastectomy, which was a horrible, maiming, deforming operation that removed all the muscles on your chest wall. So when a woman looked in the mirror, she had a big depression, and it ruined most people's lives when they looked at their physical body. So that anyway, that's what I did. And I did hundreds of those in my training and when I was in the Army. And even in my fellowship, we continued to do those. One day, I was making rounds, and I had a young doctor who was a psychiatrist with me, who I was trying to date. And I tried to impress her by showing her this 42-year-old woman who had a perfect radical mastectomy that had a big scar from her shoulder to her abdomen and a skin graft in the middle. And from a technical surgical point of view, it was great. It was amazing to look at. It was perfect. From a personal, social, emotional point of view, it was about the most horrible thing you've ever seen. And so I undraped this patient and showed her the patient, and I bragged at how good it looked. And the patient looked at the woman who was with me, and she started to cry. And the woman who was with me, who was a psychiatrist, sat down next to her, talked to her, kicked me out of the room, came out 20 minutes later, told me what a fool I was, and that I couldn't see beyond my nose, so to speak, and was completely missing the point about how women feel. Now, this was now the late 60s. It was a women's movement. Things were changing. And she, you know, essentially ripped me a new hole in my body, so to speak. Yeah. And it was I was very angry at her for what she did to me, but I learned a huge amount, and it changed my life in the way I thought about doing these things. And it kind of led me down, it changed the path in my life. It led me down thinking about, hey, we ought to be able to do better things than this. Mm. We shouldn't end up with this horrible, terrible, life-altering operation.
So here you are, it's you say it's the 60s, right?
Yeah.
You're doing these horrible maiming operations, radical mastectomies that are essentially the standard of care at that time. And the thoughts are now starting to occur to you, maybe to many other people as well. And so how can we do this better? And of course, mastectomies went through their evolution of being very radical, then modified to be less radical and so forth. But I think specifically what sparked your interest later on in your career was lumpectomies, and then how you can preserve the breast, and then more importantly, how you can even make the breast look good. So maybe, can you give us some historical background, I guess, on lumpectomies, and how do you think that came around, and why was it so difficult for so many people to accept for some time? What's the history of that for you?
So 1975, people in America started getting modified radical mastectomies, where we save the muscle. So if a woman looked at it, she still thought it was horrible. The breast was still gone. From our point of view, it looked much nicer. There was a muscle there. It was, we could make it flatter. It didn't look quite as horrible. But most patients never saw the old version at that point, so it was still horrible to them. Then I opened the Van Nuys Breast Center in 1979, which was the first freestanding breast center in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we had 10, 12 doctors there. We had a plastic surgeon. We had a couple cancer surgeons. We had medical oncologists. We had every kind of doctor that could take care of a breast problem. And then in 1981, Umberto Veronesi, the great surgeon from Italy, published the first randomized trial comparing radical mastectomy, this old-fashioned, horrible operation, with excision of the tumor and radiation therapy. And the cure rate was exactly the same at 5 years. Mm-hmm. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was a whole story about it on the first page of the New York Times in the July of 1981. Mm-hmm. And we looked at that and we said, this is changing. This is life altering. We now have an alternative to these horrible deforming operations that we have been doing. A few years later, in 1985, Bernard Fisher published the American version of that study. Mm-hmm. So we had two studies like that. And in Van Nuys, we decided that saving the breast, doing a lumpectomy and radiotherapy, would be our default procedure rather than mastectomy, which was everyone else's default procedure. So we got profoundly busy during the entire decade of the 80s.
Well, let's pause for that. So that had to have been a radical departure for you mentally to say, we're going to go from a mastectomy as our default operation to a lumpectomy, because this data was still fairly new and recently published, right? And it wasn't universally accepted everywhere either at that time. So how did you at Van Nuys decide that we were going to do lumpectomies?
Well, to be perfectly honest, as we were all Halstedian trained surgeons there, mm-hmm. we all believed in the old-fashioned way. And it's really, and old ideas do die hard. Even though these two papers I told you are published in the 80s, you don't really see any significant breast preservation in the United States until the 90s. Mm-hmm. It takes 10 years for it to catch on. But we were an avant-garde, cutting-edge, leading group of people. So we just sat around and we said, we should, these papers make sense, and we ought to do what they say they do. Even though deep down in our hearts, we were probably still Halsteadians, we decided we were going to save the breast. And that's kind of how it started. But it really took another 10, 15 years to really make its impact in America. But the thing is, we became incredibly busy because we were saving breasts. And the truth is, that's what women wanted. When they were diagnosed with breast cancer, they saw these old operations. They saw pictures of it. Mm-hmm. They didn't want it. They wanted to save their breasts. And we were the first ones doing it. We were accused of being charlatans and doing terrible things. But it was so. We got on the Today Show, Good Morning America, the show 2020, everything. We became very popular because we were doing something that most people were not doing.
That's interesting that you say that women wanted breast conservation or breast preservation at that time, because I think even today we still face this reality that once a woman has received this diagnosis, their immediate default is to think, how can I do the most to cure this disease, to rid myself of this disease? And often their default or their knee-jerk reaction is to say, I want a mastectomy. Not only do I want a mastectomy, I want both breasts removed, right? We still face that today. How, at that time, when it was not even universally accepted, did you and the women that you operate on manage to recognize and believe that a lumpectomy was effective and just as good as a mastectomy? I know, well, as physicians you did, but how did the women and the patients manage to do
that? Well, a lot of women didn't. Mm-hmm. A lot of women didn't, and we still did plenty of mastectomies during the 1980s because women talk to other doctors who did mastectomy. They talk to their friends who said, you know, get it all off, you know, don't fool around with this.
Yeah.
It turns out when you look at the long-term data, it made no difference. When we look at data now that's 20, 30 years old, the cure rate was by cure rate, I mean living and dying, which is the most important endpoint. It was exactly the same whether you did a mastectomy or a much smaller breast-conserving operation.
Mm-hmm.
The differences were that if you did the smaller operation, the patient looked better, she felt better, she felt better about herself, she was psychologically better, she was socially better, she was sexually better, she was better in every way, but she lived exactly the same. It didn't cost her anything to save her breast. And
I think that's a good segue. Everything you just said was that by doing a lumpectomy, you preserved beauty, you preserved aesthetics, femininity, sexuality, sensation, all these things that are important to women. But even the lumpectomies had their limitations, right? And I think that was like, I think you've had three major parts of your career. And let's say the third part of your career was coming to Hoge, where we met, and we really started doing a lot more volume of oncoplastic surgery. But the truth is, you were doing oncoplastic surgery long before you came to Hoge. And you probably started that at Van Nuys with the surgeons you had there. So doing a lumpectomy alone does not, by default, preserve all those things that we were trying to preserve, right? Sometimes you were left with a breast that was lacking. It didn't look as great as you wanted to. It did not match the other breast, or it had a horrible deformity even sometimes. And while you could pat yourself on the shoulder and say, we did a breast-conserving operation, it didn't necessarily achieve the goals you're trying to achieve, right? And I think that's what you recognize.
So oncoplastic surgery, which is the combination of oncologic or cancer surgery and plastic surgery, it started for us in about 1985 in Van Nuys. So remember, 81, we start doing breast-saving operations. Some of them look good and some of them look terrible, because we're cancer surgeons. We are destructive surgeons, most of us, and we don't really know how to make it look nice. And so for a couple of years, the two plastic surgeons in Van Nuys said, hey, we can help you make it better. And we were resistant because we realized that would require us opening other planes. And regular cancer surgery taught you never to do that. Don't open another plane. Don't put your finger where it doesn't belong. Don't move tissues from one place to another. That's mm-hmm. not what we did right. in regular cancer surgery. So it took 3 or 4 years of the plastic surgeon saying, we can help you make it look better.
Uh-huh.
And then finally we said, okay, what do we need to do? We've hit some of these, we've done the right thing. We've saved the breast. It still doesn't look that good. What can we do? And they began to show us different types of operations, crescent operations, mm. and then we developed a bat wing operation, and we did Benelli operations, all with their help, of course, because they knew how to do it. And then we started doing reductions, and that was by far the best operation. If the woman could benefit from a reduction and we could figure out a way how to take the cancer out with reduction, that was great. It really wasn't until you and I met that we developed the split reduction, which allowed us to get tumors in quadrants that didn't fall in the normal reduction pattern and remove it and get a good cosmetic result.
So it took several quantum leaps to get from radical mastectomy to modified radical mastectomy, from modified radical mastectomy to lumpectomy, and then from lumpectomy to oncoplastic surgery. And that quantum leap between lumpectomy and oncoplastic surgery was that you had to free yourself of these notions that you couldn't manipulate the breast tissue beyond where the tumor was, that you could do other things to the breast simultaneously while removing the tumor to make that breast look better, right? And how do you think that leap came around? Why did you think that became acceptable?
We just kept pushing the envelope and once you can save the breast and with a reduction and make it look better, and the patient is so happy, it became a new experience. It was a high to see these patients thrilled with the result, when in the past they had to be happy they were alive and accept the result. Suddenly they were happy they were alive and they had a new breast that was as good as when they started, and oftentimes better. So we took what used to always be a win-lose or even a lose-lose, and we made it a win-win. We took the tumor out, which was good. That's the win. And so maybe we cured the patient, and we made the left breast look better. That was a win-win. We never had that before in the cancer business. So that was very exciting, and we just wanted to keep doing it and offering it to more and more women. And we finally got to a thing that you and I developed called extreme oncoplastic surgery. And we defined that as oncoplastic surgery in a woman who really needs a mastectomy.
Right.
Because there are certain criteria as to when you could save the breast. Generally, the tumor had to be 2 centimeters or smaller. So 2 centimeters, what if it was 2 centimeters and a millimeter? Well, it didn't meet the criteria, so some people would do a mastectomy. We said, well, that's just an artificial line that we've drawn. I don't care if it's 2 centimeters and 5 millimeters. We could still save the breast. And that's what happened. We kept doing bigger, more complicated cases where the disease was not only bigger than 5 centimeters, it was often multifocal, meaning more than one tumor in 2 different spots or 3 different, or multicentric in 2 different quadrants. We figured out ways that we could design or redesign the reduction to fit the cancer. When you do a reduction for a cosmetic result, the reduction is designed to give the most beautiful cosmetic result.
Correct.
That's your plan. That's your goal. That's what your charge is, so to speak. When we have cancer that's in multiple different places, we have to redesign the reduction to fit the cancer. And that challenges you. How do you put it together to make it work when we've taken sort of the wrong pieces out? And we've taken the wrong pieces out because that's where the cancer is. We have to step up and meet the cancer's needs, not cosmetic needs.
Yes. I distinctly remember working with you in the very beginning, and we'd be doing these oncoplastic reconstructions, and you would send me patients that had relatively small tumors and relatively large breasts in a setting. In that setting, it was relatively straightforward to give a good cosmetic result. And as we started to do those, and we got good at those and facile at those, you started sending me harder and harder, harder reconstructions, bigger tumors, smaller breasts, and eventually evolved to doing extreme oncoplasty, which is now, I think, the cutting edge of oncoplastic surgery and probably the last quantum leap that was made. Which is that we're taking women that have probably been traditionally told by everybody else, or would have been traditionally told by everybody else, that they need a mastectomy because either the disease is too big, their breast is too small relative to the disease, or that it's in multiple areas of the breast and there's just no conceivable way. And I say conceivable because that surgeon could not conceive of a way of removing that tumor but still leaving the breast looking good. I think that's what our next quantum leap was, and extreme oncoplasty is what I think is now spreading really across the country and the world and being accepted, right?
Yeah, and that wasn't so easy either. A fellow named Pat Whitworth and I started the first oncoplastic course at the American Society of Breast Surgeons in 2004, and a lot of surgeons came. They were interested in it, but the truth is, oncoplastic breast surgery really didn't get accepted, I'm going to say, till maybe 2016, 17, 18. It never even got on the main program at the American Society of Breast Surgeons until the last 7 or 8 years. So it took a long time to really work its way up. And in terms of my dealing with you, I think I used to have a baseball analogy for you. In the beginning, when I met you, I threw you softballs. I gave you small tumors and bigger breasts. And you were so good at it that I said, I'll give you bigger tumors and big breasts. And you were still good at it. So then I said, I'll give you big tumors and small breasts. That became harder. And then I said, I'll give you multifocal tumors, tumors in different segments of the breast. And somehow you stepped up and were able to do those. And I got to a point where I almost never did a mastectomy. I mean, the last few years of my career, I probably did 3-4 mastectomies a year when I used to do hundreds a year.
Yeah.
I mean, and that was actually a very happy thing for me to finish my career not doing mastectomies.
I think that's great. I mean, you came to Hoag sort of as a way to kind of wind down your career, right? You left your position at USC where you're a professor emeritus. You came to Hogue for better commute, a nicer looking hospital, right? A better lifestyle. And in the end, I think we accomplished so much while you were here together that it's just started a whole new phase of your career that I don't even think you wanted to walk away from.
Not at all. When I came to Hogue, there had never been an oncoplastic case. Now there's many hundreds every single year at Hogue. There had never been an intraoperative radiotherapy case, which I brought that technique from USC to Hogue. And we did almost 2,000 of those in the last 10 years. And there had never been breast fellows. Hogue had always been a private hospital with attending surgeons and attending physicians. And part of my deal when I came here, I said, is you've got to let me bring the fellows, the young surgeons who are training to be breast cancer surgeons from USC to Hogue. And I convinced them to do it. And now, as of August of last year, we graduated our 63rd fellow. Yeah. And those fellows are all over the United States. They trained at Hogue and USC, and they're at Hopkins, they're at Cleveland Clinic, they're in Boston, they're in New York. They're all over the United States spreading what we taught them. And Hogue is now considered the oncoplastic center in the United States. It's the leading hospital that has done the most and the most exciting oncoplastic breast surgery.
Yeah, it's quite a career so far.
Yeah. What we have been talking about during this entire discussion is anatomy. So if we go back 100 years to Dr. Halsted at Hopkins, he did anatomy. He saw cancer. He cut around it and he closed the wound. That's anatomy. It's not biology. It's not anything. It's anatomy. And over the last 100 years, we have simply fine-tuned the anatomy in surgery. So today, surgery is incredible anatomically. You got a bad knee, we'll put a new knee in. You got a bad shoulder, we can put a new shoulder in. You have a breast, we can take a part out, re-alter it. It's anatomy. It's all anatomy. And I think with extreme oncoplastic surgery, we've gotten to about the highest level of anatomy that we can apply to breast cancer. So where do we go from here? There's not anything else anatomically that we could do. You are already doing the highest possible level that I conceive of. So the only future for breast cancer is our ability to attack it genetically, biologically, immunologically, and all of those things are happening now. And the future, it's very likely that tumors will be biopsied. We will look at their genetics and their biology. We'll give medicine that will shrink it down. And then your anatomical approach will be made easier again, rather than being pushed to the limit where you take a giant tumor out of a small breast. You may take that giant tumor, make it smaller, and then have a better approach. But in surgery, anatomy's almost at the end. You got a bad heart, we can put a new heart in. A bad valve, new valve. Bad plumbing and vessels, we bypass them. You know, so we can do almost all the anatomy.
What we can't do is grow another tissue part yet.
Right.
That's probably the next
cutting. That's biology. Yeah, but the day will come where we'll have an altered, genetically altered pig or some animal, and we'll take that heart out and put it in you, and you won't need a lot of immunosuppression, and it will work. Mm-hmm. Those days will come.
Hopefully in my lifetime.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the challenges I face sometimes when I'm counseling women. I want to see how you approach these women, which is still today, and alluding to the earlier discussion about convincing somebody that a lumpectomy is an appropriate operation for somebody. So we get patients in the office who have seen 5-6 other surgeons, have had multiple opinions, and are convinced that they need double mastectomies, and that anything short of that would be doing something detrimental to them. That they're not doing everything they can to prevent a recurrence. They want to live to see their children get older and get married. How do you counsel these women and talk to them so that they understand that what they're doing is not, or what they're planning on doing is not necessary?
Well, I think a double mastectomy is a reasonable choice for the woman with a proven genetic abnormality.
Right, of course.
That dramatically increases her risk of getting a bad breast cancer, because if she gets one, she might get four or five others, because the genetic abnormality affects all the cells. So two mastectomies is a reasonable choice in people with genetic abnormalities, although more and more, many of those women are electing to simply treat the one cancer they have now and be carefully followed and by 5 or 10 years before they do the right. mastectomies. But there's plenty of people who come in. What about the person who comes in with a small, easily cured 1 or 2 centimeter cancer who wants two mastectomies?
Right.
And you tell her, I could do 10 mastectomies. It won't cure you any more than if I do a lumpectomy and radiotherapy, because the cure rate is equal no matter what I do. So that's what you have to tell the patient. There are some people who you cannot convince that less is more. But the truth is, in the beginning, when I started, more was more. The more you did, the better it was. The bigger right. the radical mastectomy, the better it was. But today, in the cancer business, less is more. Particularly in surgery and radiation therapy, we're trying to do less surgery. So doing an oncoplastic lumpectomy rather than a mastectomy is less surgery. It leaves an intact person who actually will get back to her normal life. And here's the other thing. She'll wake up many days never even thinking she had breast cancer, never even remembering it, because she is totally intact and looks normal. But the woman with the mastectomy gets dressed every day and somehow touches her chest when she's getting dressed. She is reminded on a daily basis that she had breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So there are great psychological benefits from saving the breast and saving it in a nice way so it looks good and so that it's just a normal part of her anatomy.
Do you think that there is validity in some of the data that's come out to suggest that, contrary to the trials from the 1980s that showed that lumpectomy and radiation had a higher recurrence rate than a mastectomy, that there is data now to suggest that a lumpectomy and radiation may have equivalent recurrence rates as mastectomies? What do you think about that?
Well, there's now very interesting long-term data from the American database, SEER, and from the Netherlands and Sweden, hundreds of thousands of patients, not randomized patients, but the people who had a lumpectomy and radiotherapy actually have about a 4% better long-term cure rate than people who had mastectomies.
Mm-hmm.
The thought is, with a mastectomy, you leave some breast tissue behind and then you reconstruct it. With a lumpectomy and radiotherapy, you leave a lot of breast tissue behind, but it's all treated because it all gets radiation therapy.
Right.
So one thing, the cure rate is certainly equal, and it may be even a little bit better in selected patients. There may be a lot of myths out there, too, that why leave anything behind? And this is the truth. If you do a lumpectomy versus a mastectomy, there could be, in the old days, there was a slightly higher local recurrence rate. So you got a few more local recurrences, but you didn't die from them. They were found, they were treated, and you didn't die, and the long-term cure rates were exactly the same.
Right.
So it's a trade-off. Even if the recurrence rate is a little bit higher with local treatment, it's worth it if you can stay intact, because there are so many other emotional, social, psychological, sexual benefits from staying whole that it offsets a slightly higher local recurrence rate, if that even exists nowadays. Nowadays, we're finding cancers so early with screening that the local recurrence rates are going to be probably the same no matter what you do.
So what do you think has been the fundamental change from the time of our surgical history where more was more, meaning the more you did, the better outcomes you had, versus now where you don't have to do all these aggressive maneuvers. You can do less and still get good outcomes. What do you think has changed during that time period?
When more was more,
yeah,
it was the old days. There was no chemotherapy. There was no immunotherapy. There was no anything but the surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
And the surgical mentality 100 years ago was that I should excise this as widely as I can, And if I could do it even wider, I should do it even wider. That was the mentality and teaching for 100 years. And every surgeon learned that, so, and every surgeon respected his or her teachers, and that's what we did. And with the development of adjuvant treatments, drugs, chemotherapies that could shrink tumors, radiotherapies that really worked, immunotherapies that could help, all, of which you see advertised on the nightly news. I see all these drugs. What are these drugs? These are all new cancer drugs that they're advertising that are immunologically based. In any event, with all these other additional treatments, you don't need as big a surgery. Mm-hmm. And that's why less surgery is more now. Less radiotherapy is more now.
I agree. I'm glad that we have these options available, given the current thought that breast cancer incidence seems to be rising. What do you think contributes to that?
It's rising. Well, certainly we have more people, and we're going to have more breast cancer every single year. And we have better detection, and more people are availing themselves to mammography and other forms of screening. And there are new things that are going to be coming along besides mammography. There's going to be a way to do a CAT scan of the breast that's like an incredible three-dimensional mammogram. That's coming along in the next 10 years. There's a thing called fast MRI. That's coming along. All of these things are going to find more cancers that are smaller, that are easier to treat with very simple, non-deforming, non-life-changing operations. Most of these really early cancers, maybe they won't require chemotherapy or any other medicines or drugs. They may be simply treated anatomically because they're so small and so early.
What do you think about cryoablation?
It's never really caught on in America, but it's not much different than, for example, intraoperative radiotherapy. Cryoablation simply freezes the tumor and kills the cells, and then whatever's left behind simply dies and then gets resorbed by the body. The problem with cryoablation is that the tumor isn't really gone the next day. You have sort of a lump there, which is a frozen lump that hopefully are all dead cancer cells, which then will possibly take 1 to 2 years for the body to resorb that lump. So it's a little unnerving for people to say, I still have this lump. And the doctor says, yeah, but they're all dead, you know, but I still have this lump, and they don't like the lump there. So it's cryoablation's been around for a while. I think it's getting a little more popular now, but it certainly has not taken this country by storm. I don't think it will.
You know? I don't think so either, because it seems like the natural evolution of things would be the end is that we don't do any surgery for breast cancer anymore until we find ultimately a cure for it to prevent it from happening at all, right? But if you look at what the various modalities are to avoid surgery for breast cancer, what do you think of them? So there's cryoablation, right? Then there's neoadjuvant chemotherapy, where maybe if you get a complete imaging response, you don't operate on those patients either. What do you think about these various
things? Cryo ablation is sort of surgery. You sort of have to put something in there and freeze it. Sure. And most people, their mentality is, I want this thing out of me.
Yeah.
I don't trust that it's going to just die, or that you've frozen it, it's going to die over the course of time and be resorbed.
Yeah. But what do you think about if you have chemotherapy first, and all the imaging would suggest that it looks like the tumor's completely gone, like you've had... There was a tumor that was visible, you had chemotherapy, and now it's gone on the MRI or mammogram.
So there are studies underway now that are looking at patients that appear to be complete responders to upfront medicines, upfront drugs. What they do is they do multiple biopsies of the tumor, and then half the people get the tumor resected and the other half it's left in to see what happens. So those trials are underway. There are trials with the non-invasive form of breast cancer, ductal carcinoma in situ, where patients are randomized to needle biopsy, and then either you take it out like you always did, or you leave it in and see what happens long term. Right. So there clearly is a direction that we're heading in to look at, can we get away with little or no surgery in patients? And How will people feel if you leave a tumor in that's kind of indolent and you wake up every day, you kind of know it's there,
right,
but you know it's supposed to not do anything. Will you worry about it? Will it ruin your life? Will it make you crazy? Or can you live with it? And I think some people will have no problem living with it. Other people will not be able to stand it. You know, that's us as humans.
We'll see what the next phase brings. So the field of oncoplastic surgery is clearly growing, and there's a lot of interest amongst breast surgeons that have never trained in it or learned about it to want to do it. And even our American Society of Breast Surgeons has truly now embraced oncoplastic surgery as the leading cutting edge form of treatment for lumpectomies. Now, that wasn't always the case. I think you had a long uphill battle with societies and members to try to get this going. But now that it's there, now that everybody kind of wants to be an oncoplastic surgeon, what do you think defines an oncoplastic surgeon? What are the minimum criteria needed to be one? What do you have to demonstrate in terms of skill?
Well, I'll tell you what doesn't define an oncoplastic surgeon, and that is somebody who takes a weekend course at one of these meetings. So multiple meetings are now offering a very good comprehensive 2 or 3 day course. Maybe they even include a cadaver lab. And then they give you a certificate at the end. But believe me, 3 days or 2 days of hearing good lectures and seeing good people do this stuff does not make you an oncoplastic surgeon. You need experience. You need to think about these things. You need to begin to see these things in three dimensions. Almost like you're not the day you become a surgical resident on day one, you're not a surgeon. You can say, I'm a surgeon, I'm a resident now. But it's going to take years of training for you to really be a competent surgeon. The same is true with oncoplastic surgery. Mm. It takes years to really get good at this. And I think that the general surgeon or the cancer surgeon who is interested in breast cancer surgery should take the course. And then what they should do is they should team up with a plastic surgeon in their hospital, in their hometown, and do hundreds and hundreds of cases together. And when they do that, where they do part of the case, plastic surgeon does part of the case, they instruct each other, the plastic surgeon learns more about cancer surgery, and the cancer surgeon learns more about plastic surgery, that's how you become an oncoplastic surgeon. You do not become it in a weekend. With a piece of paper that says, you know, oncoplastic surgeon.
Do you remember our first oncoplastic case that we did together?
I certainly do.
You? Really?
I do.
I think about this story all the time. And you know this, but I'll say it again for our viewers, which is that I was just a plastic surgeon in town. I was doing cosmetic breast augmentations, lifts, and I did that for a few years, but I really wanted to get into breast reconstruction. So I started to attend the tumor boards where you were leading the tumor boards and you were talking about surgeries. And somehow or another, I got a case. I got a patient that ended up walking to my door that needed an oncoplastic reconstruction, and you were going to be the breast surgeon. Do you remember that story?
Well, actually, someone else was going to be the breast surgeon, but it turned out I had operated on her 10 years earlier at USC.
Uh-huh.
So she found out that I was at Hoag, so she said, well, can you do it with Silverstein? So we did it together, and it came out beautifully. And you were like a really nice guy. And I was used to plastic surgeons who were driving Bentleys, and I didn't like that. So you were like a nice guy with a Mazda. So we did more cases together. And the more I did with you, I said, boy, this guy, he's really good. He's got an eye for it. You know how sometimes you have an athlete and a bunch of athletes, and they're all training hard, but this one guy, he's just better. He catches better. He runs faster. He cuts better. That was you. You had this wonderful, natural sense of the field, like in athletic terms, where I just needed to hand you the ball, and that was it. And then you took it from there. And many other plastic surgeons I work with were just not as good. Even chairmen at medical schools were not as good as you were. It was just a magical thing. So I changed your life. You changed my life.
Well, going back to your assessment of what it takes to be an oncoplastic surgeon, we did, I think, at my last count, I think together about 1,000 cases, close to 1,000, just you and I together over a period of about, 14 years. And I don't think I really hit my stride until about case 200 or 300. That's when I really started to feel comfortable. It felt like you can give me any case and I'll figure out a way to help to make it better. So the idea that you can take a weekend course or do a simple instructional lab with somebody and then come out of that course being a trained oncoplastic surgeon and call yourself an oncoplastic surgeon is a little bit absurd. But I agree, that's the way I think some people will start off with their careers. I think training that way and then partnering with a plastic surgeon may help them further advance on their own, but it will take hundreds and hundreds of cases. So I don't think just simply saying I did a course, now I'm an oncoplastic surgeon is not enough.
Yeah, and patients actually, when they go to their cancer surgeon who offers them an oncoplastic approach, they should ask them what their experience is, how many they've done, how they learned how to do it. I think you should know for sure what your surgeon's capable of doing, you know, and that's
sort of, you should vet your doctor.
Yeah.
We think the future holds for oncoplastic surgery now.
Like I said, I think we've reached the end game of it. I think that some of the cases we've done, I can't think of a higher level case when we've taken a tumor out of this side of the breast and that side of the breast somehow and managed to put it together and make a really well-shaped, good breast as an end result when nobody else would want to do that. So how much further can you go? You can't go much further from the technical point of view.
I say there's one thing that's left, only one, which is to bring tissue into the breast from a distant part of the body, from the thigh or from the abdomen or somewhere where traditionally that type of surgery was reserved for somebody who had a total mastectomy and they needed a total breast reconstruction. And we reserved it for those types of patients because that surgery to move that tissue around was extraordinarily complex, time-consuming, long recoveries, things like that. I think if you could shorten the surgeries, if you get really facile at taking an island of skin and tissue and fat from, let's say, the thigh and bring it into the breast and sew it in there so that it replaces all the tissue that was removed, and you can do that in a very clean, facile, short, quick way that brings patients back to their lives quickly, I think that would be the next evolution.
It'd be great, but it needs a blood supply. You have to overcome, you know, the problem of giving it a blood supply. That's hard.
Well, there is blood supply in the breast, but again, I think that to me would be the next step beyond what we're currently doing. And we're already doing little advances in that already at Hoag, so hopefully we push it to the next level. Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Silverstein, for joining us today. It was an honor to be hosted in your own home, and I really appreciate your time. I appreciate our career together, our time together, and I hope that we'll continue to at least write more papers and create more advances, even if you're not in the operating room with me anymore. But as always, our mission is to ensure that every woman who faces breast cancer has opportunities to explore all the various and best options available to her. So thank you for creating that reality and helping push the field of breast cancer surgery forward.
It's been an honor to do this interview with you, but I'll tell you, it's been an even greater honor to spend 15 years in the operating room with you and see you go from a really good surgeon when I first met you to a brilliant surgeon at the end. That is, to me, you're almost like, you were not my fellow, like the young fellows that I trained, but it was great to see this development over time and to see you be really probably the best there is at this in this country. I don't know anybody better than you are at this.
That's very kind. Thank you.
So it's been an honor.